3CR acknowledges the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation as the custodians and caretakers of the lands from which this community broadcasts. We pay respect to the ancestors and elders of the Kulin Nation and their kin who might be tuning in today. I also want to acknowledge the Bunurong people of the Kulin Nation as the custodians of the land I'm speaking to you today from. From my lands and ancestors to yours and to your elders, I give respect. My name is Pauline Vituna and I'm the Disability Day Worker for 3CR. I'm a Papuan-born Gunantuna woman. I live with acquired disabilities on the lands of the Kulin Nation. Today, December 3rd, is the Disability Day broadcast, 3CR's annual 12-hour program with all disability-focused content. As the Disability Day Worker, the theme I chose for this year's broadcast is Embodied Solidarities. So throughout the day, we're going to hear the voices of many disabled people of different lineages and life experiences. How can we better practice solidarity with each other as fellow disabled people of different backgrounds and abilities, locally and across borders? At a time in humankind's existence where mass disabling violence is increasing, how can non-disabled people better practice solidarity with us? This is what our broadcasters were invited to reflect upon and respond to today. I chose the theme after reflecting on the way the world has been changing on a collective level since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, the ensuing cost of living crisis, the rise of conspiracy cults, alongside valid concerns about states abusing their coercive powers, and in the past year, increasing awareness of grotesque oppression and wars being waged against millions of people in the global south that Western powers are fueling, arming, or turning away from. We have witnessed both the abandonment of immunocompromised, disabled, and ill people in the face of ongoing superspreading of COVID viruses, as well as what seems like a dramatic rise in mutual aid efforts. We've seen mask blocks initiated and maintained to support people to protect themselves and others, even as many leftists espouse the same ableism as the far right. We've seen the overwhelming suppression of the plight of Palestinians in a genocide by Western nation states, whilst thousands of people lend their bodies and minds in solidarity actions every week. With that said, and thinking again about the theme of embodied solidarities, I want to play for you the opening speech by Evelyn Aurelian, spoken at the Vigil for Gaza on October 7th. Evelyn is a Bundjalung Nation descendant, born and raised on Darug country. She's a poet, researcher, and editor of Overland magazine. Overland have been staunchly in solidarity with Palestinians, fighting for their lands and people. Listen carefully to her words.
Jingibala, hello. Thank you all for gathering here. We're on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung peoples. We are just in the site of the Boonwurrung River, which has nourished the Kulin Nation since time immemorial and will continue to do so. A couple of nights ago, I was at a poetry event for brilliant young Palestinian poet Haseeb Harani and Nasser Mashni, who many of you would know and would have been listening to for the 12 months now, if not longer, asked the question of how would we feel if in the future Israel began giving land acknowledgements and acknowledging the elders past, present of Palestine. And that question just destroyed me in ways that I didn't realize I was still able to be destroyed after 12 months of being an Aboriginal woman in witness of just the unimaginable and continually escalating violence against Palestinians in their land, Palestinians who have been displaced from their land, other Arabs all throughout the Middle East and throughout the global West who have been pushed outside of their homeland and yet are still facing violence in the West simply for being Arab, simply for being Palestinian or Lebanese, for being brown. The kinds of images and stories we've been witnessing for the last 12 months are the stories that many Aboriginal people have in our family histories, some of us in recent or intergenerational memory. Seeing this genocide live streamed on our phones just after a failed referendum and just a horrific process of settler colonialism's dying gasp to prove itself somehow capable of reconciliation or any form of care for the people whose lands it stole and continues to displace and erase. I'm so honoured to be asked to speak here because I, like many other Aboriginal people and many other people, whether you've been colonised, your families have been colonised or displaced in the past, or whether you are just human and capable of witnessing and feeling, I've just been walking around with nowhere for all of that grief to go. We are marching and we are marching together, and that gives hope. It gives a certain kind of hope. But we know the story, the long story of settler colonialism, and we know that it doesn't end well. And I don't want Palestinians to be displaced from their land for hundreds more years and then watching as the settler colony that has fed itself and grown so rich off of the wealth of stolen land, giving these flimsy little acknowledgements and making bumper stickers about truth-telling and treaty and processes that they don't want and won't invest in and will set up deliberately to fail and to undermine us and to hurt us and to make us be cruel to each other in the process. The divisiveness of the consequences of settler colonialism are so nefarious, and they will continue to split our communities, to make us unkind, to make us ungenerous. But we know, after 12 months of marching and gathering and coming together, that there is no one here with hate in their hearts. We are just exhausted. And we don't know how to live with the way that this constant influx of trauma has recalibrated our brains. There is no guidebook for how to be a human right now. There is no guidebook for how to be living on your stolen land and watching as someone else's land is stolen from them in the most brutal and violent and permissible, somehow permissible way possible. I don't know what to do with that other than to keep coming together, to keep witnessing, and to keep admitting and acknowledging to ourselves what is happening. We cannot continue to participate in a settler colony that does not see Palestinians as human, because we know where that will go. Right now, in Kulin lands, it's the season of harik. The yam daisies will be starting to flower. There are tadpoles. There are cyclical movements that the land has known for more generations than can ever be counted since time immemorial. And in Palestine, the season of olive picking is beginning. And when I think about what it means to be from and for the land here, and what it means to be from and for the land in Palestine, that grief just comes up again, and I don't know how any Palestinian is surviving this. But you are so loved, and I know everyone here is struggling with that impossibility as well, and we don't know what we will do next, but we have to be here. There is no other option. I have a poem that I'm going to read. It's
one that I wrote for Black Lives Matter, but its function keeps coming up again and again. It's called The Power for Prayer, The Promise for Peace, and I think it will always now forever be for Palestine. In the absence of power, say we will not forget. In the thoughts and prayers, say we will not settle for silence. To those who are waiting, we promise we will not leave. If there will be no justice, we will not permit peace. The bloodied face of history is black, his teeth falling from a mouth that won't swallow its own tongue. The face of history is a death mask smothered against beautiful black, is a bullet to the back, is a body to the wall, is holy, like howling to forever that the sky has another star to burn. The prayer for peace says second to send grief to the soil, but first to take the soil back. Says there are some things too hallowed for forgetting, too much of history to forgive. The fury, the bomb, the cell, the throat. Nothing more holy, nothing more left to lose, no Lord, no glory. Only our blood back to the earth, only mothers weeping on the street, a child's scream in the night. The poem says speak the aftermath of history. The wall says from the river to the sea. The cry on the street says, say their names. Against every ceremony we trace to journey them home, say the thing that will bind them here until we can let them leave with justice. Instead of saying forgiveness, tell them to lift their boot from our neck. Thank you so much, and free Palestine.
That was Evelyn Aurelian speaking at the Vigil for Gaza from her Aboriginal perspective on the psychological toll of genocide and colonialism, and then reading a poem called The Power of Prayer and the Promise of Peace.
CR Community Radio, 855 AM.
You're listening to Embodied Solidarities on 3CR's Disability Day broadcast. So for this portion of the day, I really just wanted to gently introduce the theme and invite you to contemplate with me what it actually means to be in solidarity with one another in the context of disability justice and disability rights, what it means to show up for each other. And I also wanted to acknowledge how difficult that can be sometimes when you live in a disabled body, have a disabled mind, operate in a different time scale than, say, the rest of the population. I want to acknowledge groups like SLO, a recently formed disabled Sick Mad-led social and political group based in Naam, who were interviewed earlier this year on 3CR and have endeavoured to support other disabled people to engage in political protest. I want to acknowledge Crips Contra Colonialism, who is organising ongoing accessible e-vigils for Crip solidarity with Palestine, Sudan, and all colonised peoples. It can be really challenging for some people with disabilities, people with care responsibilities, people who are time poor, to really engage in acts of solidarity. What I appreciate about the disability rights community, and especially the disability justice community, is the ways that we endeavour to make political action accessible to everyone, and that really necessitates us having the lens of valuing everyone's contributions. That's not to say that every action is necessarily solidarity, but it is to say that we recognise that the ways people can give to a movement and a community vary greatly. So, for those who are unfamiliar, there's an organisation called Sins Invalid. It's a disability justice-based movement building and performance project that centres disabled people, specifically disabled people who are Black, Indigenous, people of the global majority, and also queer and trans people. Some years ago, they produced a little booklet that they titled Skin, Tooth and Bone. The basis of movement is our people. It's a disability justice primer, essentially. And you can find free copies of it on the internet in PDF form. If you're looking for non-patriarchal ways of organizing, I would definitely recommend looking up this primer. They do a fantastic job of coming up with a framework that understands that, in their words, all bodies are unique and essential. All bodies have strengths and needs that must be met. We are powerful, not despite the complexities of our bodies, but because of them. All bodies are confined by ability, race, gender, sexuality, class, nation state, religion, and more, and we cannot separate them. Is it possible to pursue class liberation and value all bodies and abilities at the same time? A disability justice approach says yes. It regards community as ecosystems and places a great emphasis on community building as part of class liberation, not something that blocks it. This is probably a good time to share with you a recorded reading by Elena MacDonald. Elena is a Paradarama person residing on Wurundjeri land. They wrote a beautiful reflection on disabled kinship in the midst of illness.
Grip Kinship. This reading is dedicated to Tinu. I've spent the past year or so in a state of suspension, of absence, subsistence, and renewal. To the outside, abled observer, I've had little to show for it. Too ill to work, too ill to study, too ill to do much of anything, and yet past year has not been empty, has not been barren. Even though I've often felt otherwise, a burden, a continual reminder of my lacking, the disabled burden, a body emptied of utility. As much as I know myself to be far more than my contributions, the narrative of burden is not so easily escaped. Even as you attempt to carve out a space for rest, for restoration and healing, there are endless reminders of the debt your existence creates. Debt that can never be repaid, this narrative will tell you. Care is zero sum. There is no mutual reciprocity. What a wasted life. The longer this non-being lasts, the more isolated you will become. Abled's become frustrated. Why are you not improving? Where are your motivational plans for building back up, for exponential growth on the timeline of life? They'll stop including you, will cease to think of you at all, except to sigh and bemoan the loss of what was. In many ways, this is a living death. What is life if you are not doing? They get tired of the answers continually being the same. What are you doing? Nothing much. What do you do with your days? Existence, nothing else. Living in the smallest of ways, impossible to explain. When will you return to work? When will you be you again? When will I be not ill? Your usefulness has been expended. They take no interest anymore. Your period of not being is seen as decadent, wasteful. How lucky you are. They cannot see the enforced poverty, the struggle to find adequate medical care, how you crawl up out of this black hole by your fingernails, how little rest you actually achieve as your illnesses resist all attempts of healing, how at the end you must return to production, even as your body desires rest. Even the seeking of healing requires money you do not have. How emptied you feel by the end of it. How despair and loneliness become soul-sucking, emptying. How around you, those more able-bodied, those more able to produce, are moving and growing and changing and creating in so many wonderful ways whilst you seem stuck, intractable, fixed fast in time. And you are so happy for them, so proud. Yet each instance is a reminder of how trapped you feel, and it begins to seem as though you will always be caught in this moment, because you know for many disabled people this is the reality. Around you, people, even those close to you, are continually reinforcing this narrative. You are no longer considered for opportunities. People's busy lives supersede your own, and you don't even have the energy to follow up. So why would you bother? And so, increasingly, you feel that you are fast slipping away out of the streams of conventional time, of even being a passing consideration at the edge of someone's mind. And yet, this is not the sum total of your life either. Your days are not blank formlessness alone, even if that is all the world is willing to grant you just now, your wasted absence of a non-life. Even as it overwhelms you and your days become a litany of grievings, of all that you have lost, all that you cannot do, all that you are eclipsed by your kin who have not made it, all that you must do and yet cannot, so that they are put off for another day and another, all whom you have been forgotten by, all whom you have disappointed by your absence, have let down. Even as it becomes more and more difficult to persist in this farce of a body, to endure your own erasure from the slipstream, all of it, and yet. There is something deeper beyond all of this, beyond the ideas of burden, of waste. The ideas of ableds are enforced upon disabled people, but they are not our realities. Even as we feel them choking out the light around us, we know they are mirages attempting to erase our borders. It is through disabled kinship that we are reminded of what lies beneath. It is disabled kinship that makes living through such times possible, grants us space to breathe, connections span across vast distances as we each attempt to find stability on our terms. There are the smallest of joys, the smallest of moments where living creeps in, and yet which could not hardly be reasonably summed up into anything of a record of a day when asked, what do you do with yourself? Exchanges with crypt kin, glimpses of their own small joys, the inner resources drawn upon to continue to persist despite, within, throughout. There are no grand moments of production, no output to show for it, but it is a life all the same. Something whole and full, something worth fighting for. It is how crip kinship refuses these grievings, refuses the elisions that insist upon your disappearance, refuses it all, even as it recognises their wounding, refuses to elide and erase, to accept as certainty the withdrawal of your presence, refuses production as the arbiter of worth, refuses a narrowed life, formless existence. And this is not to say crip kinship is perfect, some utopian benevolence that arrives fully formed, a saintly invasion of the mind. No. Crip kinship is active practice, a promise to kin that is continually renewed in mutual reciprocity, in kinship. And as much as it requires energy from the disabled body, crip kinship has no finite source. It is not a drain to enact, but a renewal of spirit, of energy, of hope. Something we draw our strength from as crip kin, within, throughout. Crip kinship makes life whole, takes up the space abled seers lack. It is learning how to be whole, complete, when there is nothing but subsistence. It is the realization of all that should be, mutual reciprocity, kinship, communal ways of being. It is resisting the restrictions of burden, of waste, of isolation. It is finding solidarity in loss, in grief. Always it has been through disabled kinship, crip kinship, that I have found my way out of those black holes. The kinship of other disabled who, like me, are so often caught between their own exhaustion, their own illnesses and struggles with the body, their own battles with ableist structures and violent medical spaces, and yet will do all they can for their kin with the energy they have. In ways ableds will never lift a finger for, crip kinship is the source from which we draw strength. It is through crip kinship that we become ourselves, whole, complete, as we are, within, throughout. Crip kinship is for survival and collective liberation.
And my thanks to Elena McDonald for sharing those words. Elena's piece weirdly made me think about rage and trying to process rage, it can be difficult to release emotions and process them through the body when you can't physically move as well. So I have another bit of audio that I want to share with you today, and I guess I can put it here. This is an interview that I did with Rodrigo Souza. Rodrigo is a Brazilian national and yoga teacher who is a wheelchair user and disabled himself. He teaches his own modality of adaptive yoga that is accessible for people in wheelchairs and other people with mobility issues. He also trains non-disabled yoga teachers how to make their classes accessible. And all these classes are available online.
My name is Rodrigo Souza. I go with the pronouns he and him. I was born and raised in Brazil. And today I split my time between Sweden and Brazil. I live 7 months in Sweden. When the winter comes, I come and live in Brazil. I deal with my nerve pain naturally with sunshine and other stuff. And I have nerve pain, so I have I have sustained a complete spinal cord injury. I fell from a cliff a few years ago, and I'm paralyzed from the chest down. I used to practice yoga pre all my accident, and then after my accident, I introduced adaptive yoga and mindfulness into my rehabilitation process. I come back to life really fast, so I became a yoga teacher, and nowadays I teach yoga to folks who has experienced trauma and disability.
That's fantastic. And that's also why I wanted to talk to you today, because I've found that there's a real gap in Australia in particular in terms of accessible forms of all kinds of somatic practice. And so I was really excited to connect with you online a number of years ago now. So for people who are listening who are interested in participating as disabled people who are maybe hesitant because they have found themselves disconnected to their bodies as a result of their disability, what would your advice be to them?
It's a very common trauma response to get dissociated after experience a physical or emotional trauma, you know, such as spinal cord injury or any kind of disability. You know, there is systemic trauma, there is like emotional trauma, there is physical trauma. It's like a lot of traumas out there. So, and for you to dissociate off your body, you know, for you to distract yourself, for you not to inhabitate your body anymore, is a very common response. So what yoga does, yoga gently brings you back in. You know, when you breathe consciously, when you meditate, when you practice mindfulness, when you move consciously, when you stretch consciously, you are inhabiting your body. You are not avoiding the discomfort anymore. And with time, this discomfort diminishes because you're not resisting to it anymore. You embrace whatever it is there to embrace. You know, you realize that there might be a lot of grief going on, but, you know, in the midst of everything, there can also be a lot of joy, you know, a lot of peace even.
Why do you think it's important for non-disabled yoga instructors to make their classes accessible for disabled people?
Oh, that's a great question, Pauline. I think they need to be aware of their own ableism, you know, because the truth is, if you never hang out with someone with a disability, you don't know shit about it, right? You start feeling sorry for that person. If you have a student with a disability, like you might want to fix that person according to your values. Like, you know, you might think that wheelchair user has a dream of coming out of the wheelchair and walk again, for example. They need to be aware of their own ableisms and don't, you know, be aware of the assumptions, you know, and meet your student where they are, rather than trying to fix, you know, goals according to your values. You know, you need to treat them equally in the room. Because I believe, Pauline, that's like folks with disabilities are the ones that need yoga the most. And we are the ones that experience yoga the least. We got to change that.
That was Rodrigo Souza, the founder of Alihopa Yoga, adaptive and accessible yoga. You're listening to Embodied Solidarities. Stay tuned for more Disability Day broadcast.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.